Okay, thanks, Stan. Well, unlike previous weeks, I'm not going to lead on Gaza. I will get to that subject, but instead I'm going to begin just by talking about recent elections. And I suppose, from our point of view in Europe, the most important being the results in the Netherlands, where much against the expectations of sophologists and the establishment, from what I can gather, Geert Wilders' Freedom Party scored exceptionally well. And instead of us having talk about the Netherlands' first female prime minister, the talk at the moment is about Geert Wilders, notorious right winger, negotiating to form a government. Now, I have to say, my own expectation, for what it's worth, and it's worth absolutely nothing. I don't know much about Dutch politics, but my expectation is that what we'll get is something along the lines of what they call in Germany a traffic light coalition, except whereas, in Germany it might be, red, green, and amber. In conditions of, a PR system that I don't think has got a particularly high barrier of entry, that what we'd be talking about would be more, well, more than three parties in the coalition. And this will be a coalition, I would guess, of the non Freedom Party parties. So, what were the results? Well, 25% of the vote to the Freedom Party, that's the highest number, and that returned 37 MPs out of a parliament of 150. What about the Freedom Party? Well, again, I'm very cautious. My research is the mainstream press, Wikipedia, and what I know. So I'm being cautious here in terms of what the Freedom Party stands for. But what is certain is that it's anti migrant, most certainly anti-Muslim migration, most certainly anti-Muslim people in the Netherlands itself. So, for example, they're against mosques, they're against the Islamization of the Netherlands. And Wilders, for example, proposes that people wearing the headscarf are banned when it comes to government buildings. So that would be courts, that would be local government, that would be, police stations. I would presume that would also include Parliament, for example. The Freedom Party is also what I will call Eurosceptic. So there's talk, for example, of organizing a referendum in the Netherlands about whether the population wants to stay or does it want to go. I'd also call it, again, on the basis of lack of knowledge, so I don't trust what I read, at least skeptical about the Ukraine war. So whether it's pro-Putin, as some of its opponents would say, I would, as I said, I doubt that very much. Is it something that you could sort of equate with Viktor Orban in Hungary? I would expect so. And it's worth noting, although we're not dealing with anything crucial here, that in terms of those that are sending arms to Ukraine, the Netherlands would actually be high up on the list. So, behind Britain, behind Germany, behind France, my guess would be that Netherlands would come next. I would have thought myself, though, that the main thing about this election is it how should I put it? It's a shot in the arm for the far right in Europe and beyond. It's a shock for the mainstream parties, for the establishment, because what we've had, I think, for three parliaments in a row are coalition governments organized around the leader of the Party of Freedom and Democracy. That's Mark Rutte. And of course, what the irony is here, although he was stepping down and he sort of put his protege forward, a Turkish Kurdish woman in terms of her origins, this party, its main thrust when it came to the election was to try to, say that it was going to clamp down on migrants. It's going to be tough on migrants and all the rest of it. And in that sense, it's not surprising if you make that the issue that people decide, well, I might as well vote for the real thing. That if we take the difference between, the Party of Freedom and Democracy and the Freedom Party, Geert Wilders' party has been consistently anti-migrant, consistently anti-Muslim. So why believe, the establishment when it suddenly picks up on the themes that they've been demonized for, for what, I don't know, a good decade or two? Let's look at other results. We have the Green Left Labour bloc coming second with 25 seats. The already mentioned Party of Freedom and Democracy that came in with 20 seats. So, as I said, if you add them together, does that give you enough for some sort of majority? I would have thought so. But on the other hand, in terms of negotiations of what the program of this government is going to be, if the past is anything to go by, what we're talking about is week upon week upon week of negotiation. Should also be mentioned, because we do have some knowledge of politics in the Netherlands through the communist platform, that the Socialist Party there, which of course has its origins bizarrely in Maoism, that I think at its peak had 18 MPs, has been reduced. If the reading of the figures, if my reading of the figures is correct, it's been reduced to one MP. And of course, the message of the Socialist Party over recent years has been that they are against the left in their own organization. They've purged the left. And what they've been doing is putting themselves forward as a coalition partner, a responsible party, a party that can be trusted with power. Well, maybe their one MP is going to be invited to join some traffic light coalition. It's not impossible. But in terms of their electorate, it's simply drifted away. And people who want to who are dissatisfied, why vote for a party whose ambition is to join a coalition within which they don't set the agenda, where the agenda is going to be set by the Labour Party, the Green Left, the Freedom and Democracy Party, or whoever? It's certainly not going to be set by the Socialist Party. So that's been a brilliant strategy, hasn't it? But of course, it's fundamentally the sort of paradigm that we've seen of what passes for the left in the world today, and that is opting for the lesser of two evils. That faced with Geert Wilders, they say that they would join a coalition to stop Geert Wilders. We've seen that in Greece. We've seen that in Spain. And of course, what happens is the left reduces itself either to a tail of the bourgeoisie or simply takes the path of liquidation and ends up disappearing. So, yes, the Socialist Party got a grand total of 3.2% of the poll and one MP compared with 18 at their height. Okay, I said I'll talk about elections. The other election that's worthwhile mentioning is Argentina, where, of course, we have the so-called anarcho-capitalist Javier Milei, that's the best you're going to get from me, elected by a margin of 11% over the Peronist candidate. And of course, what we saw in Argentina is a very similar pattern, that we see elsewhere. The left, of course, rallied behind the main alternative, or the only alternative, if we're talking about two rounds. And that was the candidate of the Peronists. And the irony here, of course, is that the winning candidate, being an anarcho capitalist, promises all sorts of things. He's going to abolish the local currency, replace it with the dollar, get rid of the central bank, get rid of abortion, get rid of all sorts of rights and gains. Take a torch to Social Security. The irony here is that, in terms of the previous Peronist presidency, it's been young people who've been on the streets protesting, it's been young workers who have been striking who end up voting for this anarcho capitalist. So I haven't got a clue what's going to happen. In Argentina, it's not inconceivable that he turns to extra constitutional measures. I don't know enough about the constitution of Argentina, but it should be stressed that while the far right has won the presidency, that doesn't mean that there isn't constitutional checks and balances. There are. In the form of Congress? Does he turn, for example, to the army? Does he rule by decree? Does he conjure into existence fascist bands? I don't know, but all of those things are at least a possibility that ought to be considered. And of course, in terms of the right, the big one is coming. Next year, we know the exact timetable. And of course, what I'm thinking of is the hegemonic power, the United States, and it goes into official election mode in 2024. And thus far, amazingly, given the number of court cases against him, it's Donald Trump that's the candidate to beat. And not only the candidate to beat within the Republican Party and its primaries, he's way out ahead when it comes to them, but actually in polling when it comes to the national election. And of course, in America, what we have isn't, simply a one person, one vote for the presidential candidate. What we have is a sort of monarchical. President elected indirectly through the Electoral College, which gives right-wing states a distinct advantage when it comes to choosing the Senate, but also the president. Now, there is this extremely common. Extremely unhealthy view on the left that somehow, capitalism and democracy, go together like the horse and the carriage. Now, that's something, of course, I was taught at school. It's something that, the BBC promulgates. It's the main establishment view. And I suspect that that's been the case since when? Maybe the 1920s. I'm not sure, but certainly after World War II, when the United States took over leadership of the capitalist world, it took over leadership of the capitalist world in the name of democracy, and it contrasted that with the communists in the East, the Soviet Union, the Eastern Bloc, China, and of course, it's worthwhile saying that in terms of our tradition, we used to be known. I'm not trying to revive the word, by the way, but we used to be known by the title social democrats, social society, socialism, that sort of type thing, but also Democrat. And I think there's a very good argument. August Nimtz has made the argument that if there any if there's an any individual who should deserve prime place when it comes to the struggle for democracy in the 19th century, their name is, or the name is, Marx Engels. Marx Engels were extreme Democrats, and it was their party, their influence, that above all was responsible for anything like approaching universal suffrage, certainly when it came to Europe. Either way, we still have this idea. I think because of the retreat of the Russian Revolution, because of Brest-Litovsk, where the Bolsheviks lost their SR allies, the Left Socialist Revolutionary Allies, of where you had the replacement, of rule by peasants and workers in the form of that coalition government with rule of the Bolsheviks, which, yes, had a solid majority, at least in 1917 in the Workers' Soviets. But the retreat of the Russian Revolution, to the point where Lenin, who is always brutally honest about these things, talked about the nature of the regime in Soviet Russia hanging on the consciousness of 6,000 old Bolsheviks. In other words, the working class had become declassed, the Soviets became a mere rubber stamp. And what happened under those conditions is that Comintern itself retreated from the struggle for democracy. And of course, what you had left is the majority social democrats in Europe didn't struggle for democracy. What they struggled is to preserve the capitalist order in Europe. And so what we had, for example, in Germany, the most important country in Europe, in spite of its defeat in World War I, is the championing of the Weimar Constitution, which they quite rightly said, compared with what went before under the Kaiser, was a model of a democracy. But it should be pointed out that the communists were not struggling in the 1930s for democracy. How could they, when you look at the Soviet Union, where you had not just a one party dictatorship, but increasingly, the term, not only the rule of the party, in the name of the party or in the name of the working class, but increasingly the rule of the Central Committee, then the rule of the Politburo, and finally, in the 1930s, a monocracy ruled by Stalin. Either way, it should be emphasized that if we look at the Weimar Constitution, the most modern, up-to-date, progressive constitution in the world, according to majority social democrats, this had provisions in it for the president to decree to rule by decree. And that's what the social democrat president did, and it's also what happened when Hitler was appointed by the president, by Hindenburg, as chancellor. And we all know the story. Hitler ends up ruling by decree. bans the communist, bans the social democrat, bans the left-wing trade unions. But he continues to rule till 1945 under the terms of the Weimar Republic. But yet we still have a left that doesn't see the struggle for democracy as central. And precisely, views a situation as Trump, therefore, or as Geert Wilders, or what's just happened in Argentina, what's happened in Hungary, and we could list and list and list as something that they can understand only in one way, and that is to describe them as fascist. And in my view, that's doing violence to history. It shows a profound lack of understanding of what fascism was and is. In my view, I think amongst Trotsky's best writings, it was on the question of fascism. And precisely what he described there is fascism as the organization of some sort of petty bourgeois mass into non-state fighting formations in order to smash the threat to capitalism of the organized working class. Well, the tragedy in the United States, the tragedy in the Netherlands, the tragedy in Hungary, and one, as I said, can carry on, is that the organized working class does not represent a threat to capitalism. And in my view, what we need to understand is that capitalism, it doesn't go hand in hand with democracy, does not bring democracy. What we have is capitalism conceding to the working class elements of democracy. Meanwhile, the capitalists will do their damnedest to hollow out democracy and indeed to roll back democracy. So I think the idea, I agree with the right in America that the United States is not a democracy. That if you look at Britain, in 1920, was it a democracy? When it's a monarchy, when you have the House of Lords, when you don't actually have universal suffrage, i.e., no votes for at least large slice of the female population. And then you've got the whole question, as we try to hammer home during the period where Jeremy Corbyn was leader of the Labour Party, there are all sorts of checks and balances within the constitution, not only the monarchy, but the army high command, MI5, the whole question of the courts, all exist to actually stymie democracy. And then we come, of course, to the real question of global power and, Mike Pompeo talking about pushback against Jeremy Corbyn. So the idea that the left has got that capitalism is democratic, I think, is a profound misconception. The capitalist class are only democratic in the sense that most companies, limited companies, have a situation where there's democracy by shareholder. In other words, you don't have one person, one vote, you have one share, one vote, i.e., what we're dealing with is the power of money. And if I'm a billionaire, therefore I have more votes than you, if you're a mere shareholder and you've only got one share. That is capitalist democracy. So within their sphere, they have democracy, but it's shareholder a democracy. It's not one person, one vote. Okay. So that's that one out the way. Okay, I wanted now to move to the Gaza question in the widest sense. I was on the demonstration yesterday in London. The organizers claimed 300,000 people. When I got home and I heard that claim, I must admit that I was somewhat startled by it. I'd been on the previous one where the claim was 800,000. I was on the one that they claimed 300,000 before that, and I was on the first one. And I don't know how many were claimed for that. Either way, in terms of myself, I positioned myself at the front of the demonstration, and I watched the entire demonstration pass me by. And I have to admit, at one point, when people stopped coming, I was positioned on a corner. I actually had to go around and have a look and say, "Well, where's the rest of the demonstration? It had finished." So if I wanted to guess in terms of how many people were there, my own guess, as I said, would be more like the 30, 40, or 50,000, not 300,000. I have to say, of course, that didn't surprise me. Given what's been going on, in Gaza and on the border with Egypt, and what we've had in terms of the exchange of people, 4 day ceasefire, maybe followed by another ceasefire. The main slogan of the demonstration was "Ceasefire now." So it's hardly surprising under these conditions that people say, "Well, I'm not going to go on this week's demonstration." So to me, it was noticeably smaller. It was still big. It was still militant. It was still passionate. There's no doubt about that. But it didn't surprise me that it was smaller. All I was surprised by is the claim of the organizers. A couple of things about the demonstration. I didn't see a copy of it actually on the demonstration. I've seen it subsequently. You all know the story of the Met Police giving out this leaflet warning people of what you mustn't do, what word you shouldn't, come out with these words, you shouldn't come out with these symbols, you will be arrested if you do, that sort of type idea. This is a new one, and clearly this is the Met Police buckling to pressure from the former Home Secretary Suella Braverman, that was accusing them of being soft on pro-Palestinian demonstrations, not banning them because they were hate marches. No, they weren't, Suella. That's a big lie. They weren't anti-Semitic. What they were, in general, if I wanted to characterize the demonstration, they were pro-peace, pro-ceasefire. But what they were overwhelmingly is pro-Palestinian. And yes, there were plenty of chants of, from the river to the sea, which no, doesn't mean wiping out the Jewish population. What it means, and I'm not a partisan of it, but what it actually means is a one-state solution within which the existing Jewish population would have equal religious rights with the other religions of the region. So, for example, the various Christian denominations and also Muslims. That's actually what the vast majority of people who use that slogan mean by that slogan. And I would include in that the vast majority of the Muslim Brotherhood, even if they take the form of Hamas. What their actual program would be, if by some fluke, and it isn't a realistic prospect, is it? And that's why I don't go with the slogan, such a one-state solution could actually be realized in practice. What would happen then? I haven't got a clue, but then we're starting to move, in my view, more into the realm of science fiction than realistic politics. And I won't go there. We've discussed that question on other occasions. Okay. What else to say? A few things. When it comes to the BBC, the mainstream media, what we have is a story of the exchange of hostages for prisoners. I don't like that terminology. Terminology, we don't need to get hung up on it, but the idea that what we've got is hostages on the one side, and then people who've been banged up, for right, on the other hand, is entirely wrong. And indeed, what we have in terms of Israel is an awful lot of people who have been detained either for a short time or sometimes for year on y and years on the basis of no trial, no charges, but you're detained because you're perceived by the authorities to represent a danger. And even when there has been a trial, often it's for throwing a stone. Often it's for being associated with Hamas or the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine or whatever. And the idea, when you come to a 97-year-old woman or when you come to a 5-year-old child on the other side, but it needs to be understood that in terms of Israel, whether you're male or female, between the ages of what, 18, I don't know until when, maybe 55, maybe 60, you're liable not only to be called up for military training, but military service. And therefore, really, what we're dealing with here is the exchange of people. Note that when it came to Israel opening its prisons to release its prisoners, what we had is teenagers as well as women. We weren't dealing with Hamas fighters or anything like that. Either way, you can see why, in terms of asymmetrical warfare, Hamas and Islamic Jihad, and I don't know about the Popular Front, would have taken people from southern Israel, because what we've had, against the judgment of not a few armchair generals, John Bolton, for example, in the United States, has decried this ceasefire in order to get Israeli citizens back. What we've had is a cessation of fighting. Yes, we have the promise that fighting will restart, but the United States, remember, holds the whip hand in the last analysis. And what we're dealing with here isn't simply the United States backing Israel with X billion of military aid or something like that. What we're dealing with is Israel being militarily dependent on the United States. And that is doesn't mean that it's dependent on the United States for new F-16s or new F-35s or new Abraham tanks or something along those lines. We need to understand that, and it's something I've only really appreciated recently, is how much maintenance high-tech, war fighting equipment needs, and therefore how many replacement parts are needed. So, for example, my understanding is if you take an F-16, which is your sort of standard NATO, fighter bomber aircraft, which Israel will have, for every hour that it spends in the air, it takes 24 hours of maintenance. And of course, they're not just, oiling the parts, they're also replacing parts. And if those parts aren't coming from over the Atlantic, those F-16s stop flying. So the United States has the ability not to, wield the big stick in public, but it can certainly, whisper in the ear of Netanyahu and the war cabinet that enough is enough. Why? Not because of the suffering of the Gazan population, or for that matter, the suffering of the population on the West Bank of Palestine. No, it's what is going on in Saudi Arabia, to use a phrase, on the Arab street? What's going on in Cairo? What's going on in Amman? What's going on in the cities of Iraq, Lebanon? Will the masses tolerate further suffering for the population of Gaza and the West Bank? And to me, that's what the Americans are calculating. Because in my view, if you look at the Hashemite monarchy in Jordan, you look at the Saudi monarchy in Saudi Arabia, if you look at the Sisi government in Cairo, all of these governments are extraordinarily fragile, extraordinarily vulnerable. And it wouldn't take that much. And the Americans know it as well, that these regimes could be swept away, could crumble in the face of a mass upsurge in terms of solidarity with the Palestinian people. So these governments, yes, pay lip service in terms of solidarity, have to do the diplomatic dance, but clearly there will be the vast mass of the population will know that they're lying through their teeth. Okay, just two more comments on Gaza question. Today, we had in London, just like we had in the previous weeks, the Washington demonstration and the demonstration in Paris, a demonstration by people who are supporting the Jewish population. That's how it's been advertised in London. So we have various sort of ish prominent people, Maureen Lipman, if anyone remembers her. I think she was famous for the wasn't it for the phone adverts? I sort of vaguely remember. Tracy Ann Oberman, but Boris Johnson was there. The organizers claimed 60,000 people. Well, I wasn't there, so I'm not going to argue with it. Worth noting that they didn't want to be associated with Tommy Robinson. Who can blame them? He was arrested and taken away by the police. Were the police issuing leaflets telling people what slogans they could chant, of what sort of banners they could display? So, for example, could you display a banner that equated the Islamic moon with the crooked cross? I don't know, but I somehow doubt it. No, it's the freedom of expression of the left and of Islamic and Muslim opinion that is being attacked, and it's been attacked on the basis that to stand up for Palestine is to be anti-Semitic. And I've emphasized that this is not true. It is true with a minority, there's no doubt about it, but it is an extremely isolated minority. Okay, just a final comment on that. And that is one of the slogans that was on display in London today was not only zero tolerance against anti-Semitism, but never again is now, i.e., what this demonstration was bringing to mind, of course, was the 42, 43, 45 Holocaust of European Jewry in Europe, where who knows how many died? 4 million, 6 million, 8 million. Do we actually know what the total was, given that this was part of an overall Nazi slaughter of Slavs, Russian prisoners of war, gypsies, disabled people, communists, social democrats? It was industrial slaughter in Eastern Europe, that's for sure. Either way, if we are talking about genocide today, it's not Jews in London that are threatened. For that matter, it's not Jews in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem that are threatened with potential genocide. if we're going to use that word, and I personally have got no problem using it in the context of Gaza, and maybe who knows what the developments will be on the West Bank, but certainly in terms of Gaza, when you've got over 2 million people, displaced from the north, crowding in the south, and then being displaced in the south itself, all dependent on food aid, all dependent on power, all dependent on medicines that are not coming from the outside. The danger is obvious, and that's first and foremost the outbreak of contagious diseases that don't just kill hundreds, that could potentially kill tens of thousands. And of course, we need to understand that the Nazi death machine wasn't only about putting a bullet in someone, not only about gassing someone, it was also about diseases killing people off. The Israeli authorities might not be directly responsible, but clearly, under, for what it's worth, international law, if you deny people food, if you deny them power, if you deny them medicines, you are responsible for what happens to them. So, yeah, I agree with the slogan, never again is now. Are they talking about the population in Gaza? No, that is not what this demonstration was about. What this demonstration is about is solidarity with the Israeli Zionist state and its alliance with the Western powers, crucially, its alliance with the United States. Okay, one development that is worthwhile mentioning, and I'm going to close in terms of Gaza with this one, is David Cameron, the new British Foreign Secretary, and his raising the two-state so-called solution. And he says quite rightly, well, if you ignore, a political solution, you shouldn't be surprised that you get Hamas. You shouldn't be surprised. We don't support the atrocities and all the rest of it. But you shouldn't be surprised, by desperate people in desperate circumstances resort to desperate measures. So you must start to address a solution. Of course, his solution, I think, is illusory. I would expect myself, to be, reasonably intelligent bourgeois politician with advisors who are certainly intelligent in the Foreign Office, that a two-state solution is a non-runner. And it's not a non-runner because of Fatah or the PLO in Ramallah. And it's not a non-runner because of Hamas in, well, I was about to say in Gaza City, but you know what I mean, in Gaza. It's a non-runner because if you look at the dynamics of Israeli politics, that here we have a colonial settler regime with the dynamics of a colonial settler regime that moves it into an ever more hostile position vis-a-vis the natives. And that's why, yes, it is a work colony. Its logic is to exclude the Palestinian population, not only from the workforce over time, but also to exclude the Palestinian population from the land that your colonial project claims. And of course, the land that Zionism claims, we can go into the fantasy about from the river to the river. That's, I don't know, is that into Syria or is it into Iraq and all the way to the Nile? But no, let's just take our classic, Israel-Palestine, where we actually have the annexation of Golan Heights, but crucially, 500,000 at the very least settlers on the West Bank. This is what the parties of all Zionist hues and colorations are committed to. This colonization did not begin with revisionist Zionism and the Likud. It began with Labor Zionism. It was Labor Zionism that conquered the West Bank and Gaza in the 67 war and imposed Israeli rule on these areas. We now have the revisionist Zionists and parties to their right, all of which are either absolutely explicitly open or semi-open to getting rid of the Palestinian population. I mean, you have seriously, you have Labour Zionists that talk, for example, about the demographic time bomb in Israel. And this is with a 20% Arab population. If they incorporate the West Bank, then you're starting to move thereabouts to an equal population. Can you have one person, one vote under those circumstances? I wouldn't have thought so. For Netanyahu actually being in a position where he had to negotiate with some Islamist party in order to keep out of jail was one thing. To have to negotiate not with some fringe party, but something that's sitting in half of the Knesset seats is clearly not compatible with Israel as a Zionist a state. Either way, even if you have Israeli politicians who stand up for a two-state solution, they don't mean it. And that's been true from the very beginning when the two-state solution was suggested. So although you have David Cameron, although you have the Alliance for Workers' Liberty, although you have Joe Biden, although you have the Morning Star and the CPB and the official Communist Party in Israel and the official Communist Party in Palestine calling for a two-state solution, it will never happen. It's as delusional, actually, as a single state solution, because you have to ask who is going to deliver it. And it's not going to be the United States. The United States is not going to force Israel to deliver a two-state solution. Israel will resist that idea, by tooth and nail. Okay, let's just move on. Quarter an hour-ish or thereabouts left. There was a by-election on Thursday. A lot of comrades, certainly if you were outside London, you might not have noticed it, but this was a by-election in Newham, which is a borough in East End of London. It's a very poor borough in London. Lots of Muslim voters. And what we had is the election of Safia Najib, by 47% of the vote. Now, what's noticeable here is that Safia, only a short time ago, was a member of the Labour Party and resigned from the Labour Party in protest against Sir Keir and his stand on the ceasefire question. Remember, he was just trailing behind Joe Biden, who was trailing behind Netanyahu and the Israeli war cabinet. So there's this by-election in Newham. She stood as an independent. It's true she fought on local issues, but she also fought on the question of Palestine and Gaza and trounced the official Labour candidate. So she got 46% of the vote. The Labour Party candidate got 27% of the vote. My problem precisely is this. That those comrades, and they might be right because we don't know what's going to happen in Israel, Palestine. We don't know what's going to happen in Egypt or Saudi Arabia. There's an awful lot that's imponderable here. There's an awful lot of unknowns. But if you look at the demonstration on Saturday, if my estimate is anywhere near accurate, and it wasn't 300,000, but it was nearer 30,000 or 40,000 or 50,000. This is exactly the point that we've been making, that you can have a passionate response to what Israel has been doing in Palestine over the October 7th action carried out by Hamas and others. And you can have huge numbers of people taking to the streets of London, but very quickly it subsides. And if these people aren't organized, then this anger dissipates and we move on to the next question. And that's precisely the point, that at the moment, this human mass is not organized. The Palestinian Solidarity Campaign, no doubt, and I know it, is getting lots of recruits, but it's hardly a substitute for a political party. And what we have in Newham is people standing as independents. Sophia, for example, joins the independent group on Newham Council. My fear is that come the next general election, if the independents stand in Newham, I mean, it's possible to envisage them being elected in a general election. It's just that somehow I doubt it, that such organizations, to the extent there is an organization, is swept away in the choice that people actually have in front of them. And that's choosing a new government, not a new prime minister, a new government. Is it Tory or is it Labour? And in Newham, the tendency would be that people would vote Labour in spite of Keir Starmer's stand last year when it came to the Gaza question. And I'll just pose this just as a sort of thought experiment. Imagine if Keir Starmer, for one moment, had gone along with his 56 rebel MPs in the House of Commons, had gone along and sort of been persuaded by the eight front benchers that resigned over the Gaza question. What would have happened to his prospect of becoming prime minister? I don't, I mean, I'm simply approaching it from a bourgeois point of view. I don't think that would have been a clever move, in spite of the huge anger that we've talked about out there in the country, in particular with Muslim voters who, historically will tend to vote Labour by an overwhelming majority. What would have happened to Keir Starmer? In my view, the Telegraph, in my view, the Times, in my view, the Sun, in my view, perhaps the Daily Mirror, maybe even the Guardian would open up on him for breaking ranks when it comes to the alliance with the United States. In other words, Keir Starmer ends up either in the position of Jeremy Corbyn, who was considered a complete anathema, or he ends up perhaps more realistically at the level of Ed Miliband, or for that matter, Gordon Brown. Okay, Gordon Brown was Prime Minister, Ed Miliband, but remember, the press ran story after story against Gordon Brown. He couldn't sign his own signature properly. Remember the that stupid, that bigoted woman incident. Remember Ed Miliband couldn't even eat a, was it a bacon butty? Couldn't even eat a bacon butty. No stories against Keir Starmer at that level at the moment. But imagine what would have happened if he broke ranks with Netanyahu, i.e., Biden, and the Anglo-American alliance. In my view, that would have severely damaged his chances of becoming prime minister. And indeed, you can imagine an Anthony Blinken talking about pushback against this potential prime minister and maybe looking around for another potential candidate to replace Rishi Sunak. Yeah, maybe from the Labour Party, but not Sir Keir Starmer. So Sir Keir Starmer didn't go down that route. And I think from a bourgeois point of view, he wasn't being stupid. And I think we need to understand that. Okay, just a couple of other stories, and I'm going to have to be brief. I'm going to be briefer than I was aiming to be. Just wanted to talk about net migration. What's the figures? 745,000. This is what Suella Braverman talks about being a slap in the face of the British people. I have to say myself that when I heard, remember David Cameron, when he was up there fighting the general election against Gordon Brown, when he talked about getting migration, net migration down to the tens of thousands, I had to say that I did guffaw with laughter. You're not going to be able to deliver that one, Dave. And indeed, perhaps because he couldn't deliver it, then we saw the result that we did see with Brexit. We'll leave that one aside. The point I would make, though, that Rishi Sunak's made a similar albatross for himself in the form of the small boats. If we look at the small boats, it's a very small contribution to this 745,000. What's the figure? 25,000 over on small boats. What should be emphasized, though, in terms of this figure, is how many of them are students, how many of them are Ukrainians, how many of them are Hong Kongers, but also how many of them are coming from places like the Indian subcontinent to fill low-paid jobs in the National Health Service, not least in the care sector, which is of course private. And there you are, you have Rishi Sunak boasting about how he's been successful in keeping wages in the public sector down. Well, of course, what happens if you keep public sector wages down? People go out and look for another job that's higher paid in order to, keep their living standards up. I don't know how many vacancies the National Health Service has. I would have thought 100,000 would be a pretty safe bet. And that is what's happening in terms with a large slice of British migrants. And it's a form of robbery. I don't like the term, but I'm going to use it nonetheless. It's a form of robbing human capital from India, from the Philippines, from Ghana, from the West Indies. The British Health Service nicks their doctors that they've paid for the training of. It nicks their nurses, and it nicks cleaners and all the rest of it, who are prepared to work for wages that British workers can't keep their living standards up to. Okay, so that's just a quick comment there. I'm not going to elaborate further on the question of migration. We have Mike McNair writing on the subject I'm now just about to touch upon in the forthcoming paper, and that is on the question of polemics and style. So I'm going to be very brief on this one. I don't think I'll be able to stick within the exact hour, but I'm going to do my best to be as brief as possible. We've got a letter in this week's paper from Kat Rylance, and I'm not quite sure what she's saying, but what she says in the course of her letter is polemics are all very well, but we shouldn't have polemics, or we should have polemics without personal responses. Well, if you look at the Weekly Worker, if you look at the Leninist before it, we've never, taken the fun out of someone for wearing glasses. We've never taken fun out of someone, for having a big nose. We've never taken the fun out of someone, because of their personal appearance. What we attack is people who are identified with a political program because of their politics. And instead of indulging in polemics of where the vast majority of people don't understand what's being argued about because they can't, read a name in this polemic, they're left wondering, what's going on. It reminds me, of the time of the Cultural Revolution in China, when bourgeois experts, maybe they were right, I don't know, were telling us when Mao Zedong wrote a poem and he referenced some, 11th century emperor, Really, what this was about was a polemic against Chuang Lai. They might have been right. I don't know. Were the Chinese masses aware of this? I don't know. But I could give you other examples along similar lines that only the charm circle would know what's real and what's not real. The rest of us would just read an article. To me, that's useless politics. This is elitist politics. We want to democratize politics and let everyone in to the argument, that they actually understand the argument. And you can only do that if you actually name names. So if we're told, for example, there's a dispute in Rishi Sunak's cabinet, and journalists speculate, about who's on what side, we actually want to know. We want to know about the Labour Party, but we also want to know about various organisations on the left in the same way. We also want to know about the CPGB and its circle in that way. So I don't know what the comrade is saying about without personal responses, except perhaps what she's saying is that when we reply to her, we shouldn't mention her. So if we don't mention Kat Rylance, will our readers know what we're talking about? I would suggest not. But this isn't our tradition. It's not only not our tradition when it comes to the Weekly Worker and the Leninist, it's not our tradition in the big sense, i.e. the Marxist tradition. If we think back to one of Marx's early works, what was it? The Poverty of Philosophy. Well, this had very little to do with poverty. It had very little to do with philosophy. What this was a polemic aimed squarely at Proudhon, one of the fathers of modern anarchism. Why did he aim his polemic against Proudhon? Because Proudhon exercised enormous influence on the left in France and beyond. And of course, he just published his own book, which wasn't called The Poverty of Philosophy. It was called The Poverty, it was called The Philosophy of Poverty, right? So Marx was directly replying to Proudhon. Now, Marx, in a letter somewhere, says, well, after I wrote my book, our friendship, they met apparently in, what was it, 1844, came to a sudden and permanent end. But as I said, it wasn't about Marx, picking on Proudhon as an individual. What it was is picking on Proudhon because he was the leading thinker of an entire school that called itself Proudhonist, or could be called Proudhonist. And for those that read Capital, the three volumes plus plus plus, well, you could only but be struck by, of course, this not only was a polemic against the likes of Ricardo and Adam Smith and other such economists of the Scottish English school. It was also a polemic against Proudhon and his version of socialism, which is a cooperative socialism, which has the artisan or the peasant, the male, the patriarch at the core of this system. You get rid of the capitalist, but Marx's argument was, and you can see it in Capital, is you can start off with commodity exchange, but you end up inevitably with capitalists, with the concentration of capital. You inevitably end up with a capitalist class. You inevitably end up with a proletarian class that has no property except its ability to labor. Just in my last few minutes, worthwhile mentioning, of course, anti-juring. What's a juring? Well, there wasn't a juring called a thing. It was Herr Juring, who was a professor in Germany, who exercised some considerable influence on the Social Democrat Party. Silence yourself, Stan. Thank you. Who exercised considerable influence in the German social democracy. And it was Marx that persuaded Engels to open up a polemic against Düring, not because they cared one way or another about Turing, but what they cared about is the baleful influence of Turing's ideas on German social democracy, and therefore, given German social democracy's position in the world movement, on the international movement. And all I need to do is say the word Lenin, and what you're dealing with there is wall-to-wall polemic. If you look at Iskra, that was founded by Lenin and others, this was a polemic, not a, how should you put it, you have your say, we have our say. This was a polemical war conducted by Lenin, crucially, against the economists. And if we look at Lenin after that, when he was ousted or when he resigned from the editorial board of Iskra after the Second Congress, who was he fighting? And he was fighting. He was fighting the Mensheviks and fought them week by week, day by day, in polemics where he sort of tore at Plekhanov for his betrayal, Martov for his betrayal, and other Mensheviks. And of course, also in World War I, Lenin launches himself against someone who would have been previously regarded as something of a mentor by the Bolsheviks, Karl Kautsky, the so-called Pope of Marxism. And indeed, in polemic after polemic, Lenin made the point that Kautsky, if anything, is far more dangerous than the open chauvinist. Kautsky was someone who did not support the war. He's someone who took a social pacifist position. But crucially, what he said is that we should not split with the right. His first excuse was that the war will be over by Christmas. The split in social democracy will be over. It will soon be an event that we can leave behind us and we can carry on as before. Lenin was demanding a split. And that's also what separated him, of course, from Trotsky, who he named as a Judas in again one polemic after another. Now, you can agree or disagree with Lenin or Turing, or you could disagree with Trotsky and his polemics against Stalin in the 1930s, you know, calling him the gravedigger of the revolution. But I think that what we're having on the other side is, in effect, a call by the opportunists for censorship. That you can have polemics against us, but don't call us opportunists, don't call us social chauvinists, don't call us gravediggers of the revolution. And that's exactly, of course, what right-wing social democracy said to Rosa Luxemburg when she talked about social democracy becoming a stinking corpse. They said, well, don't use personal insults. Well, this wasn't a personal insult. It was a political judgment. And if they felt insulted by that description, so be it. You want people to understand that these people have crossed a line. That these people are no longer comrades, but have gone over to the class enemy. But it's also true with those that want to conciliate with those that have gone over to the class enemy. Either way, it's far more healthy for us to have honest and sharp polemics than it has, you know, than it has a diplomatic language. And I just finish with this. Comrade Kat, ironically, in her polemic, you know, includes, of course, resorts to a personal response, inevitably, to Mike McNair, and accuses him of what is it, misrepresenting her argument and resorting to untruths. Well, maybe Mike McNair did, maybe he didn't. But I want Kat Rylance to precisely say not only what she disagrees with Mike McNair's politics, but crucially, we want the politics out. We want to deal not with the style of polemics. We're going to stick to our sharp polemical tone. What we want to know is what are the political differences that she's got with the CPGB? We know when she resigned from the CPGB, she did so in the name of broad partyism. She went over along with Chris Strafford to this, what was it called, anti-capitalist initiative that was going to campaign against betting shops or whatever the hell it was going to be. No, we objected to this broad party project, but not because, on principle we can't join them. It's just that we took the assessment, particularly of the, what is it, ACI Anti-Capitalist Initiative. We just thought it was a nonsense, as it turned out to be. But we've involved ourselves in these various broad front projects, but we do select what we think are worthwhile, what we think aren't worthwhile. Either way, what we would urge Comrade Cat and others is to come out with their politics. That would actually take us forward, not with this shadow boxing about not resorting to personalities. This is to use a phrase, a red herring. This is a diversion from what we need to get down to, and that's actually discovering what the political criticisms are. Maybe the political criticisms are right, but let's actually hear the political criticisms. Thank you, Stan.